The systematic trashing of the computers at the tax and tithe headquarters had done great damage to the Chojiro's reputation, which was why there were so many Chojiros at court today, to remind everyone of the size and power of the clan. They were currently replacing the tax computers at their own expense, and adding extra levels of protection to ensure the same thing could never happen again. Within the clan, those responsible for installing the original security systems had already taken their own lives to make atonement. Bibi Chojiro had come to court specifically to act as spokesperson for her family. She had been trained to appear the perfect smiling front, the acceptable face of a feared family. She was diplomat, dealmaker, and deception incarnate. She was Blue Block, after all. Accompanying her in a matching kimono to remind everyone of the harsher Chojiro face was the investigator Razor. His face and hands showed the marks of recent burns, but no one was stupid enough to ask how he'd got them. Investigators never acknowledged their pain, if indeed they actually felt any. It was hard to tell with investigators. Everyone was giving Bibi and Razor plenty of room for all sorts of reasons, allowing them to talk in private. Bibi smiled at one and all, and talked quietly with Razor, who stared straight ahead, his cold eyes ready for any threat.
"How is our infiltration of the wolf businesses going?"
said Bibi, her smiling lips barely moving.
"Surprisingly smoothly. Daniel and Stephanie are so concerned with their own intrigues they haven't noticed a thing. Valentine has his own interests these days, and has left them alone to sink or swim. They've done well enough, but they have little real experience with industrial espionage. We have people, apparently entirely unconnected with Clan Chojiro, on every level of the company, from the very bottom up to and including the board of directors. Wolf security is good, but without competent management to direct it, it's been drifting aimlessly of late."
"It's been too easy. I can't believe Valentine is completely uninterested in the company. It's the base of his family's current wealth and position. He's had to invest practically everything in the Wolf and Campbell coffers to get the Star Drive companies up and running, with hardly anything left for a safety net. And soon we'll be in a position to subtly sabotage Star Drive construction from beginning to end. I can't believe Valentine doesn't know what we're doing."
"He has his own interests. I regret to say my people are unable to confirm exactly what those might be, apart from the obvious. People we send to find out tend not to come back."
"And you don't find that worrying?"
"Investigators don't worry. It's bad for the image. You continue with your schemes. I'll see no one bothers you."
Bibi nodded curtly.
"We can't hold off any longer just because we're not sure what Valentine's up to, if anything. Give the orders. I want to see significant errors in Star Drive construction appearing by the end of the week. Make sure it's something showy, something the news shows can run with. Once the delivery of the new drives has been not just slowed, but all but stopped, it shouldn't take too long to convince the Empress that the Wolves aren't fit to be in charge of such a vital concern. And we'll be right there, ready to take over at a moment's notice. After all, who has a better claim? We're already producing all the computers for the new starships."
"Unless Valentine does know and is already planning something really devastating. There's more to Valentine than we see. There has to be. My own recommendation is for a more leisurely approach. The Wolf's weak spot is Daniel and Stephanie. There is much in their tangled relationship that might be profitably exploited."
"And that is why you're in charge of carrying out security rather than planning it. I could do anything to those two, up to and including killing them slowly. And Valentine wouldn't give a damn."
"But if we could reach them, turn them to our cause, perhaps through pressure on their current closeness, or by providing information about Lily and Michael."
"No. Daniel and Stephanie are too erratic to place any trust in. They're weak, but they're still wolves. I have a better idea."
Constance Wolfe, widow of Jacob, stood alone in the crowd. She was always alone now, no matter where she went. 18 years old, still wearing black, in mourning for her murdered husband. Tall and blonde, breathtakingly lovely, even in a world where beauty was commonplace, the fire had gone out of her, leaving her looking like a crushed flower. Out of perhaps all the Wolf family, she had truly loved Jacob. The others mourned for a while, even Valentine, but they all had their own lives to get on with, and they did so as soon as they properly could. Constance had had nothing but Jacob. He was her life. Now he was gone, and she didn't know what to do with herself. She had no interest in politics or intrigues, and she was allowed no place in family affairs. Jacob's children had never approved of his last marriage to someone even younger than they. There had always been the possibility Jacob might disinherit them in favor of her or her children. Now he was gone. They were able to ignore her with something like relief. She looked around at the assembled courtiers, and no one looked back. She was no one now. They had no time for failures. Until one woman met her eye and smiled. Bibi Chojiro. Constance looked at her thoughtfully, and Bibi moved unhurriedly toward her, still somehow graceful despite having to trudge through the deep snow. Constance knew she should see the woman as an enemy, but she didn't have the energy. Bibi stopped before her and smiled again.
We should have got together before, Constance. We have a lot in common. It's hard to be a woman alone. I know. But just because one family's abandoned you, it doesn't mean we all have. You have friends, Constance, if you want them.
Constance looked at her icily.
I may have fallen from grace, Chojiro, but I'm not so low that I would consider betraying my kith and kin.
Bibi's smile didn't waver.
What I have in mind is in the best interests of the wolves. Valentine is leading you all to disaster. He's lost inside his own head and sees only what he wants to see. Daniel and Stephanie only have eyes for each other. The new star drive will fall from their hands, and then what will happen to the wolves? To the family Jacob built and brought to greatness. What will happen to you, Constance?
If you've something to say to me, Chojiro, say it.
You could be head of the wolves. Valentine could be removed as insane, Daniel and Stephanie as incompetent. And since they've taken steps down the years to remove all other major players from the game, that would just leave you to take over. Now, alone, you couldn't hope to run the family. You've only ever been on the fringes of things. But if you were to marry a Chojiro, we could merge the families through your children. Until then, you would rule the wolves with our help. Think about it. You'd never have to be alone again. You're young, Constance. You have your whole life ahead of you. Don't throw it all away in loyalty for people who despise you.
You want something. You all want something. Get to the meat of the matter. What do you want from me?
Information. You're still a prominent wolf with access to areas my people can only reach with difficulty. There are questions we need answers for. In return, we would make you one of us. A valued member of Clan Chojiro, cared for and appreciated. Isn't that all you ever really wanted?
Constance looked at her thoughtfully, and while she didn't say yes, she didn't say no either. Bibi turned and gestured for Razor to come and join them. The investigator plowed through the snow as though it wasn't there, and bowed politely to Constance. She nodded briefly in return, watching him warily. Bibi gave her a reassuring smile and put a proprietary hand on Razor's arm.
Investigator, you were there when Jacob Wolf died. Tell Constance what you saw.
He did not die at the hand of any Campbell. The wolf was stabbed from behind by his eldest son, by Valentine, current head of your clan. It was very quick. No one else noticed. But I saw it.
And you know investigators never lie.
Bibi was careful not to sound too pleased about it. Constance pressed her lips together, though whether to keep her mouth from trembling with rage or to hold back tears, she wasn't sure. It had always troubled her that no one had ever claimed the kill for Jacob. It would have been a major triumph for any Campbell, and they'd needed a triumph badly in the bad days after their downfall. But no one ever claimed to have killed the wolf. No one even saw how it happened, though she'd questioned enough people. She'd assumed the Campbell himself must have done it before he was killed. Until now. It never occurred to her to doubt Razor's word. He was an investigator after all, and lying was beneath him. Besides, it sounded true. Valentine had every reason to kill his father, and not a scrap of conscience to stop him. He could have gotten away with it in the heat of battle. Constance looked steadily at B.B. Chojiro.
Tell me more.
Finley Campbell, outlaw and terrorist, once the most fabled fop and dandy of his age, and under another name, secretly the masked gladiator, darling of the bloodthirsty arena fans, hung upside down on the end of his rope, and wondered if perhaps he was getting a little too old for heroics. Spread out below him lay the wide streets and bristling avenues of Golgotha's main city, the Parade of the Endless. It took its name from the endless supply of would-be heroes who came thronging every year to try their strength and courage in the arena the city hosted. The aristocracy lived in the city, too, in their tightly guarded pastel towers, because, after all, this was the very best place to be, to see and be seen in all the empire. Apart from Lionstone's court in the Imperial Palace, but you went there only when summoned. And if you were wise, you made out your will before you went, just in case. Finley decided that his thoughts were drifting in unnecessary directions. Hanging upside down with the blood rushing to your head will do that to you. He sighed once, reached up and took a firm grip on his line, and hauled himself back up, hand over hand, till he reached a convenient resting place on the side of Tower Silvestri. Luckily, the Silvestri family went in for Rococo design, so that the sides of their tower were crusted with hundreds of niches and unexpected curves, full of ugly little statues with exaggerated genitals and faces only a mother could love. Finley squeezed in beside a particularly well-endowed gargoyle with dyspepsia and got his breath back. All this time and trouble just to climb a 900-foot tower. Definitely getting past it. Be taking milk in his coffee next. If it hadn't been for his safety line, he'd have made a really nasty splotch on the ground below. That was what you got for hurrying. Normally, he'd have known better, but he'd fallen behind schedule. His own fault. He'd stopped off on the way to the tower to indulge himself with a good meal at a decent restaurant. Nowhere fashionable. He couldn't afford to be recognized. But since his clan had fallen prey to an extremely hostile takeover by Clan Wolf, he'd been forced to flee for his life. And the only people he could flee to were the Clone and Esper Underground, who were fine when it came to courage and ideals and sticking it to authority, but rather lacking in the comforts department. In particular, Finley missed the fine cuisine his position entitled him to. While never exactly an epicure, he knew what he liked. Soup so clear you could swim in it. Meat served very rare. In fact, just kill the beast, dismember it, wave the meat in the direction of the fireplace, and then slap it down in front of him. That was all he asked. A few out-of-season vegetables, just for bulk and fiber, and finally, a disgustingly sticky sweet to finish on. Heaven. Absolute heaven. He'd been denied it for so long, and the smells wafting out of the little tucked-away bistro he passed proved just too tempting. A quick glance at the watch face embedded in his wrist had assured him he was well ahead of schedule, so he allowed himself to be weak. He hadn't looked at his watch again till after his third helping of dessert, and was horrified to see how much time had flown while he indulged himself. He dropped a handful of coins on the table and ran out the door like a man ashamed of the tip he was leaving. He'd got to the base of Tower Silvestri with aching lungs, a stitch in his side, and his recent meal rumbling rebelliously in his stomach. It was a wonder the guards hadn't heard him. He followed the agreed-upon approach, slipping between patrols, and threw himself at the side of the tower, like a sailor fresh home from the sea, visiting his wife. He was still very late, and he'd hurried the climb, which was how he nearly came to be decorating half the pavement with his insides. He checked his watch again. He was cutting it very fine. He worked on his breathing, slowing it determinedly back to normal as he stared out over the city. The pastel tower stretched away in all directions, a forest of metal and glass and alien stone, gleaming prettily in the sunlight. He glanced at his reflection in the mirrored steel behind him. He needn't have worried about anyone recognizing him in the bistro. He didn't look at all like he had used to. In his glory days, he looked like nothing so much as a multicolored bird of paradise, dressed always in the brightest silks and graces current styles allowed. tall and graceful and fashionable to the very moment, from his polished leather thigh boots to his velvet cap. On his last visit to court, with his fluorescent face and metallized hair, he had worn a long frock coat that showed off his exquisite figure, and a pair of jeweled pince-nez spectacles he didn't need, and everyone there had bowed to him as one of the not-so-secret masters of fashion. Now look at him. The face in the reflection could have been anyone. He was just 25, and looked at least 10 years older. His long hair was a yellow so pale it was almost colorless. At court it had shown a bright metallic bronze, curled and bouncing over his shoulders. Now it hung limp and lifeless, and he didn't give a damn. He wore a simple leather headband to keep it out of his eyes. He knew he should cut it short. It would have been much more practical. But somehow, he couldn't bring himself to do that. It would have been too much like cutting his last link with the person he used to be. Once his clothes had been the peak of fashionable excess. Now he wore a loose-fitting thermal suit with a chameleon circuit that took on the colors of his surroundings. Finley smiled briefly, and the man in the reflection smiled back, but Finley still didn't recognize him. That man looked rough and hard-used, and very, very dangerous. His eyes were cold and careful, and his smile had only a sad humor in it. He could have been an ex-soldier or a mercenary, hired muscle for sale to anyone with the right price. He had the look of that most dangerous of men, someone with nothing left to lose. No, he thought firmly, and made himself look away. He still had his love for Evangeline, and the new cause he'd embraced. As a noble, he'd never thought about the lot of those beneath him, let alone the non-people, the clones and espers at the very bottom of the heap. Then he came face to face with the horrors of Silo 9, also known as Wormboy Hell, where rogue espers were imprisoned, tortured, and eventually executed, and what he saw there changed him forever. Now he fought for justice for all, and if he couldn't have that, he'd settle for revenge. Which was what had brought him to Tower Silvestri in the first place. He forced himself to his feet and began climbing again. His arms and legs trembled from the strain, but they'd get him where he had to go. The underground had offered him a choice of stimulants, chemical miracles to put a little pep in a tired man's muscles, but he'd turned them down. He'd never needed chemical courage in the arena, and if he wasn't quite the man he used to be, he was still the best the underground had. He laughed breathlessly as he flung himself on, clambering over jutting gargoyles and howling stone faces like a swift-moving shadow, his chameleon suit blending him seamlessly into his surroundings. Maybe after this, the Silvestri family would take the time to rethink their image. Gothic Rococo was all very well and picturesque, but it made sneak missions like this a breeze. On a high-tech building like Tower Shrek, with its featureless walls of steel and glass, he would have been spotted in a minute. But like everyone else, both clans put their faith in extensive high-tech security systems, which, to be fair, were all you really needed most of the time. They were more than enough to see off your average thief, spy, or industrial saboteur. They were enough to keep out anyone, unless you happened to have the backing of those cunning cybernetic anarchists, the Cyber Rats, bless their dark little hacking hearts, who were currently feeding Tower Silvestri's systems a bunch of comforting lies, with no mention at all of the silent figure darting up the defenseless exterior. He reached the end of his line and stopped to lean companionably on the forbidding stone statue of some noted Silvestri ancestor. He pulled up the line and wound it securely around his waist. He'd come as far as he needed, just as well given the state of his aching arms and legs and the cold sheen of sweat on his face. He scowled, breathing deeply. He'd built his muscles as a gladiator in the arena, and despite his recent enforced absence from the killing sands, he prided himself he was still in damned good shape. The climb alone would have killed a lesser man. He flexed the muscles in his arms and legs, blocking out the pain. He was almost there, just a little farther. He swung carefully out and around the stone statue, and made his way slowly across the face of the tower, finding hand and footholds where he could. Forget the pain building in his muscles and back. Forget the precarious holds, the gusting wind, and the long drop down. Just climb, foot by careful foot, and concentrate on his mission and the kill at the end. For most of his adult life, the world had known Finley Campbell only as a fop and a dandy, highly visible at court, and a constant disappointment to his renowned warrior father. No one knew of his secret second life as the masked gladiator, undefeated champion of the Golgotha Arena, except for the man who trained him and the woman who loved him. But now he lived down below in the underground, and she had returned to the world above, to Tower Shrek and her awful father. Her position and connections among the occupants of the Pastel Towers made her too valuable for her to be excused for long. So they held each other one last time and tried not to cry, and said goodbye in choked voices. He went with her as far as he could, and then stopped and watched her walk away until she disappeared into the distance. Finley Campbell walked back to the underground alone, and if a part of him died that day, he kept it to himself. It didn't interfere with his being the killer the underground needed for their ongoing struggle. He'd never been much interested in politics, and never would, but he had developed a grudging respect for the rebels and a willingness to fight on their behalf. Apart from that, he didn't have anything much in common with them. He had nothing to say to them, and didn't understand or care about what interested them. They thought he was naive, and he thought they were boring. He also spent a lot of time sulking, because he no longer had access to the pretty clothes and sparkling parties that had so distracted him when he wasn't in the arena. The underground didn't have time for non-essentials like fashion or parties. When he wasn't sulking, Finley tended to brood about the destruction of his clan, the triumph of his enemies, the wolves, and what Evangeline was doing without him. All in all, he was a pain in the ass most of the time, knew it, and didn't give a damn. So the underground did their best to keep him busy with missions, for both their sakes. It wasn't difficult. The underground had a lot of enemies, and Finley had an endless need for a little action. So he volunteered for all the high-risk missions. The underground accepted, and they were both happy. It was hard to tell which of them was the more surprised that he kept coming back alive. This mission was pretty typical. The underground had marked a powerful and particularly vocal opponent for death, and Finley was to be their instrument. Only this time the target and intended victim was the notorious Lord William St. John, second in command to the Lord High Dram himself, and therefore constantly surrounded by a small army of well-armed guards and high-tech security. Never moved in public without his people covering the ground for miles around in advance. A portable forescreen for emergencies and his own personal flyer to carry him everywhere. Completely untouchable. Unless you were mad, desperate, or supremely skilled. Like Finley, who was all three at various times, according to his needs. Which was why he was currently crawling up the side of Tower Silvestri like a tiny gray spider, hopefully overlooked by all. He finally reached the relatively deep recess he'd noted earlier on the architectural plans the cyberrats had dug up for him, and he pulled himself into it. There was just room for him to curl up into a ball and still keep a weather eye on the scene below. He was about 120 feet up, and snug as a bug in a rug, waiting. Lord William St. John would be here soon, according to the underground. Billy Boy the Bully Boy, whose word was death for clones of Espers, and anyone else who got in his way. Billy the Butcher, hated and reviled by practically everyone, but entirely untouchable because of his position. The Empress was said to be quite fond of him. And he was coming here to Tower Silvestri, stopping off with his armored entourage, to pay his compliments to his friend and ally Lord Silvestri, on his way to officially open a new orphanage nearby. Appropriate, really, given how many orphans St. John and his people had created over the last few years. Since Dram became the Empress's official consort, as well as Warrior Prime, he'd had to delegate most of his duties in the field to his second-in-command, St. John. Billy Boy had taken over the pursuit and persecution of potential rebels, and the execution of rogue clones and espers, and did it all with great efficiency and even greater gusto. Blood and death followed in his wake, and he was never known to bring in his prey alive. Cruelty and slaughter were his pastimes. Mercy was not in him. The underground had voted unanimously for his death. St. John's execution would send a message to the Imperial Palace that could not be ignored. No one would weep for his passing, not even his own kind. Of late, St. John had taken to playing politics, seeking to improve his position to something more than just the Lord Hydram's shadow. He went about it with his usual vim and venom, and made enemies among his rivals with sneering abandon. Opening a new orphanage was safe and uncontroversial, and bound to get St. John good publicity. The man of action with a soft spot for big-eyed children. Couldn't fail. All the big hollow networks would be there. Finley grinned. They didn't know it, but they were in for some of their best ever ratings. Finley hadn't missed the similarities between himself and St. John. They were both men with a need for blood and death, and a willingness to get their hands dirty in the process. As soldiers in a war, they'd have been heroes, feted by all, with medals and commendations. They'd have been comrades, perhaps even friends. Sitting around a roaring fire in winter with drinks in their hands, toasting old campaigns and lost comrades. But if there was a war, Finley and St. John were on different sides. And the similarities between Finley and St. John just made it that much more of a challenge. Finley looked up sharply. He could hear the publicity circus approaching. A brass band led the way, marching down the street in full ceremonial uniforms, playing something pointedly martial and patriotic. After them came a full company of St. John's private guards, conditioned by mind techs to be loyal unto death, surrounding a small personal flyer on which St. John stood tall and proud, smiling and waving to the crowds that packed the street. Finley was unimpressed. The crowds had appeared with suspicious speed. One might almost think they'd been paid to gather in just the right place to impress the holo cameras. St. John was looking good in his everyday uniform with no decorations. Nice touch, that. Meant to suggest that at heart he was just one of the boys, just another soldier doing his job. He was tall and broad-shouldered, with a barrel chest and a handsome face, the best the body shops could supply. And if his smile was a little practiced and his eyes a little cold, well, people were used to that in the politicians. Finley ignored the man, concentrating instead on his flyer. It was really nothing more than a large personalized gravity sled with extra armor, decorated so lavishly with precious metalwork and studded jewels that even Finley's taste was faintly appalled. You needed style to bring off that kind of excess, and Finley had a strong suspicion St. John wouldn't know style if it walked up to him on the street and bit his nose. Just another reason to kill him, and put him out of everyone else's misery. The air was shimmering slightly around the flyer, four screens generated by the craft to ensure the onlookers kept a respectful distance, strong enough to turn aside an energy beam or the blast from an explosion. St. John's security people knew their business. However, four shields kept out everything, including air. So the four shields covered only the sides of the craft, leaving the top open so St. John could breathe. It wasn't much of a risk. At the first sight of a flyer or a gravity sled approaching from above, the top would be sealed instantly and maintained for as long as it took the potential threat to pass. No problem. Unless, of course, there was no flyer, no gravity sled. Just one man, crouching precariously in a recess in the wall of the tower above St. John. Finley grinned. He'd spotted the opening the moment the underground had explained St. John's security setup to him. Attack from above was thought to be impossible, given the surrounding tower's security systems, but even the most sophisticated instruments could be fooled or bypassed by a man willing to take risks, a man who didn't care whether he lived or died. The openness of that thought shocked Finley for a moment, mostly because it was true. He could live without a family or his place in society, but he couldn't go on without Evangeline. Events were conspiring to keep them apart, possibly forever. And a life without Evangeline wasn't worth a damn to him.